On today's edition of Silver Screen News, so much money and so much box office news between Barbie, Oppenheimer, and the unfortunate Blue Beetle that's going to be arriving, as well as some horror thrills, and we've even got some Star Wars news for you.
And of course, we go back 10 years, 20 years, and 30 years for Throwback Thursday, all on Silver Screen News.
Hello, everybody. Welcome, as always. It is Wednesday, Tuesday at the time of recording, Wednesday at the time of viewing. We are here. We are here to bring you the latest rundown of all things movie related and news, movie news related, where we give you our take on the latest trending movie stories and invite you to share your own views in the comment section down below. As always, my name is Nico Lero.
And I'm the one, AJ Anthony Jordan.
And if you want to skip to a precise news story and you're watching this on YouTube and not listening on the podcast, if you do want to listen to podcasts, we are available on all podcast platforms. And if you want to jump to a specific news story, there are timestamps in the description down below, or you should be able to see it on the little scrolly bar at the bottom. But with all that set and said and done, AJ, let's get right into what is hot off the press. Oh, we've got a lot of things to talk about this week, AJ. So many interesting things. AJ, I'm just Ken, boy, because we got to talk about Barbie, don't we? We have to talk about Barbie. So we both had the, I don't want to call it pleasure, but I don't want to call it displeasure. We both saw Barbie, and we're both going to talk about our experience. The opportunity to see Barbie, yes. We're going to tell you about what we thought, but before we tell you what we thought, we need to discuss, I mean, the crazy box office weekend that Barbie has just had. And there's lots of things to celebrate in this box office result. It's good times. So Greta Gerwig has made history as Barbie has the biggest opening weekend for a film directed by a woman ever. Barbie made $377 million at the box office, while Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer, which we're going to discuss in our next story, took home $174 million. This is international, of course, making Barbenheimer biggest box office weekend of 2023 so far. And fun fact, which I researched, it's the fourth biggest box office weekend in history. How crazy is that? Greta Gerwig has made history as Barbie scored a US $377 million, which is the equivalent of £293 million, opening weekend around the world, making it the biggest debut ever for a film directed by a woman. At the North American box office, combining the US and Canada, Barbie claimed top spot with a massive $155 million in ticket sales from 4,243 locations, surpassing the Super Mario Bros. Movie and every Marvel film released this year to become the biggest opening of the year. The social media-fueled fusion of Gerwig's Barbie and Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer as Barbenheimer brought moviegoers back to theaters in record numbers to see both films as a double feature. Oppenheimer also soared past expectations, taking in $80 million from 3,610 theaters in the US and Canada, making it Nolan's biggest non-Batman debut and one of the best movie ever starts for an R-rated biographical drama. It's also the first time that one movie opened to more than $100 million and another movie opened to more than $80 million in the same weekend. First time ever. When all is settled on Monday, US time, it will probably turn out to be the fourth biggest box office weekend full time, which I've just said at the, you know, now that we're recording on the Tuesday, that's happened. Internationally, Barbie earned $182 million from 69 territories, fueling its $337 million global weekend. Barbenheimer affected ticket sales for Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, of course, which fell 64% after a healthy-ish opening weekend, but with having strong reviews. Having lost IMAX screens to Oppenheimer, the Tom Cruise vehicle added only $19.5 million to North American box office takings, which in total reached $118.8 million. Women drove the historic Barbie opening, making up 65% of the audience, according to Post Track, and 40% of ticket buyers were under the age of 25. This is the comeback weekend Hollywood has been dreaming of since the pandemic. There have been big openings and successes, Spider-Man No Way Home, Top Gun Maverick, Avatar The Way of Water among them. But the fact that two movies are succeeding at the same time is notable. It was truly a historic weekend and continues the positive box office momentum of 2023, said Michael O'Leary, president and CEO of the National Association of Theatre Owners. And yet in the background looms disaster as Hollywood studios continue to squabble with striking actors and writers over a fair contract. So, AJ, Barbie's done big business. Are you surprised at all about this? And what were your thoughts on Barbie?
I'm not shocked, because what I saw in the lead up to Barbie was every person excited for Barbie. People didn't want to admit they wanted to see Barbie. Mainly guys, I'm going to be honest, didn't want to admit they wanted to see it, but they knew they were going to see it. So me being one of the first to say I've actually seen it, they were like, oh, you've seen it? Like, what was it like? And then they're like, yeah, I'm actually going to go and see it. So it came out of confession time. But yeah, women were all over it. So I'm really not shocked. Honestly, not shocked. And going back, again, as I said in my review, what was really positive was just seeing a cinema so packed. I went at 1 p.m. I thought, I'll beat the school kids. No. The place was packed. Just a few seats empty. The minute it finished, people were walking in to sit down and secure their spot. That's how excited people were for this film. And I was pleasantly surprised by the film. I feel that I expected a whole level of cheese. I didn't expect the life lessons that came out from it. I thought that, you know, it might be heavy-fisted, hand-fisted and cheesy all the way, and you get a couple of messages in the way. It was really well balanced. So, like, no, well done to everyone in that film. It actually delivered way more than I expected.
I'm similar to you in this sense. So I saw it at a 2 p.m. screening thinking, oh, we'll be okay. Oh, God. The screen was so full. And can I tell you, it wasn't just the full screen that impressed me. It was the noise, bro. The clapping and the applause and the screaming of joy from the female contingent in the audience, which outnumbered me about 800-1, I think. I only saw two or three other guys who were in the cinema as I was leaving. Like, it was a sea of women, and it was beautiful to see. It was like, so clearly women rushed to this movie. They felt like they were enfranchised. They felt empowered to go see this movie. Awesome. Without, you know, poo-pooing on anyone's parade, I thought the movie was fine. I think it'll go down as one of the, I think what this movie did that was so well is it captured the zeitgeist. You know, it hit the right notes across numerous generations, just like Super Mario did, at the right time. I think it was perfectly harmless. It had some really, really good messages in it. I thought the plot, unfortunately, was, I mean, predictable would have been an improvement, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. I thought the ending was genuinely terrible, like terrible. They could have done so many more interesting things with that. You know, they could have gone full meta and said, you know, she could have said her name was Barbie Robbie or Margot Barbie or something. They could have gone really meta with it. And also, it, you know, not, this isn't going to be anything new to people who are regular viewers. I thought Will Ferrell was terrible in it. I thought if you took him out the movie, this isn't so much a condemnation on him. This is more the character that was written for him. If you took him out the movie doesn't change. It's literally the same movie. And there was only one point in the movie where I nearly turned to my wife and I nearly said, can we leave? Just because it was getting under my skin so much. That chase scene in the Mattel Towers was painful. Painful. And it just, you know, it was even people who initially laughed when they saw Will Ferrell on screen were not laughing at that. But it had its moments. The messaging was good. I thought Ryan Gosling stole the show. In a movie all about Barbie, I thought Gosling absolutely stole the show for me. Who was the standout for you?
So it's funny. I'll give Margot her props because she was Barbie and she showed different levels of Barbie. But it was the angle. Now, I don't want to turn the tables. You were given one villain, you know, going in, you expect that to be the villain, and then it turned into another, which then gave you an element of a different star emerging. So I could kind of agree with you on that. Like, without, I don't want to get into spoiler territory. I feel the film's still that bit too new. It gave a different angle. Yeah, do you know what I mean? It gave a different angle, which then says, okay, I can see how you can become the star. I thought everyone kind of played their part, you know. It goes back to it. That whole part, as you said, because of the angle, it looks like it could go somewhere and then certain characters could have a stronger emphasis. Once it didn't go that way, they became very, very redundant. But it still played in. I just like the way they were very self-aware of the errors along the way in the world of Barbie. What I didn't like, and correct me if I'm wrong, and this is more for anyone who's played with Barbies, I'm not going to break it down to genders. As much as there are multiple versions of Barbie, which the world shows, Barbie also had friends. I'm aware of this through commercials. I didn't need to see the United Colors of Benetton with everyone being Barbie. You know, I don't mind if you call that one whatever one of Barbie's friends are. I'm not part of that crowd, but do you know what I mean? In this Mattel world or Barbie land, it wasn't a case of Barbie and friends. And I get it, it would be weird, but it just felt like not everyone had to be Barbie because they were friends. It's the same way you've got Ken and then there's that one side character guy played by Michael Cera. It would have been cool to have not acknowledged that there are female women that aren't Barbie in Barbie world. That was the thing that kind of bugged me. And I feel there were certain times it did drag a tad. But apart from that, yeah, it was cool.
Well, this is just it, you know, in reference to what you were saying about the movie dragging when you came out, it dragged because there was a lot of character. There were a lot of filler characters in this. You know, Michael Cera, take him out, movie's the same. Will Ferrell, take him out, movie's the same. There was too much filler for a plot that was basically paper thin. But I don't want to detract from what was ultimately, for most, an incredibly positive cinema experience, and it should be celebrated for that. Any movie that can put bums in seats, irrespective of quality, to drive the message home that cinema is alive and well, gets a pass in my books. But I want to hear, have you guys seen Barbie? What do you all think of it? As always, please leave your thoughts and your comments down below, and we'll reply to you on the in the comment section. So see you guys down there. But AJ, it's not just been a big weekend for Barbie. Ooh, as you just saw, it's been a big old weekend for Oppenheimer, bro. It was a big, big, big weekend for Oppenheimer. Now, little bit of context. Everyone was saying for ages that Oppenheimer's going to make $100 million. Like, first off, no chance in hell, quote McMahon, no chance in hell, on the simple basis that outside of the Batman movies, no Nolan movie has ever opened to $100 million. So least of all was going to be Oppenheimer. However, Oppenheimer truly surprised me with just how much it made. It is a case of I told you so, and it didn't open to $100 million. But for a Nolan movie, which, you know, are long, they're usually quite heavy, they're not for everyone. And this one, least of all, which is, you know, a partially black and white R-rated drama, this is called counter-programming to Barbie of the highest order. And it did so well. Oppenheimer's box office opening is bigger than Inception, Interstellar, and all but two Nolan movies. Give you one guess which those two are. Oppenheimer's dazzling open weekend domestic box office gross outdoes all of Christopher Nolan's non-Batman movies, including Inception. Oppenheimer has scored a huge opening weekend for director Christopher Nolan, the movie which is his first since his 2020 science fiction epic Tenet, don't know if I'd call it an epic, but okay, opened in theaters on July 21st, boasting a huge ensemble cast that includes Cillian Murphy, Emily Blunt, Matt Damon, Robert Downey Jr., Gary Oldman, and many more. It follows the life of physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer and the creation of the atomic bomb. Per The Hollywood Reporter, the Oppenheimer box office has raked in a dazzling opening weekend domestic gross of $80.5 million. While this still led the movie to open at number two behind the smash hit Barbie, it is the best opening weekend for a Christopher Nolan movie outside of The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises. It beat the opening weekend of his previous hits, Interstellar, which, here's the thing, I told everyone, no one listened. Interstellar opened to $47.5 million, and Inception opened to 62.7 million. Go back a few episodes. I said on the show with AJ, the average of a Christopher Nolan opening is 50 million. Nah, it's going to make 100 million. Learn. Watch and learn. So, but why is Oppenheimer doing so well? One curious thing about Oppenheimer's blockbuster success is the fact that it doesn't necessarily seem like a strong commercial prospect. A biopic, as I said, a biopic about a physicist that is nearly 3 hours long and features many sequences shot in black and white isn't necessarily a guaranteed summer blockbuster. However, there are quite a few factors that helped it to rise to the top of Nolan's filmography. The first and most important factor is its success is the release of Barbie. While the Barbie box office trumped Oppenheimer's gross with an opening weekend north of 150 million, the fact that both movies were released on the same weekend led to a cavalcade of memes mashing up the diametrically opposed titles, which helped boost publicity for both. Oppenheimer was presented as either counter-programming to a perfect or double feature with Barbie, allowing it to succeed in a way it might not have if it was the weekend's sole release. Oppenheimer also succeeded thanks to Nolan himself. This is the point I want to drive home now, AJ. The director has become a huge brand name on his own merits. Whether or not he is working with an established IP, like he did with the Dark Knight trilogy, thanks to his penchant for epic high-concept movies with A-list ensemble cast, his approach to the life of Oppenheimer likely ensured more audience members than a straightforward biopic would have it if it was helmed by another director. So, AJ, neither of us have seen Oppenheimer at this stage, but, why do you think, given the success of Barbie and given the recent terrible box offices for big movies like The Flash, Indiana Jones, Mission Impossible, not terrible, but also not great, how is it that this came out on the same weekend as the biggest movie of the year, Barbie, and yet still did numbers?
I'm going to kind of agree with the article. I do believe that Barbie was something there. It gave people a buzz of this is that. And you were like, hold on, this is that at the same time. And it's really weird because for all the love and excitement I had for Mission Impossible, I completely forgot that it was out. I completely forgot. There was this certain magic that's there. Nolan, it's weird. I think the cast works well as well. You know, Nolan has me, even though Tenet was an entire flop, that's the one blemish I have, with this guy. Like, his films deliver. Cillian Murphy is one of the biggest stars going with Peaky Blinders at the moment, and I think there's a lot of people who just caught that attention to him. There was something very simple but very eye-catching about the Oppenheimer poster as well that made people pay attention. A couple of history buffs are going to pay attention to it. The counter-programming, the science guys, like the Big Bang Theory people out there have something to go for. And what's weird is that it's a great ensemble cast, but you have to be a real movie buff to really pay attention because I don't think the names are out there. And it's weird that that isn't something you can call a contributing factor. The fact that, like, look at the poster that we've got here. You're seeing Cillian Murphy. The fact that you've got Emily Blunt, Matt Damon, Florence Pugh, Robert Downey Jr., you know, Rami Malek. Come again?
Gary Oldman.
Like, all of these powerhouses that are in there, but it's not shown on the poster. So as much as I'd like to say that that was the attraction, I don't know. There was something very mystical about this weekend that I can't put my finger on. I wanted to be a Barbenheimer this week. I just didn't have the time to be one. And, you know, I had hoped to be here right now saying I've seen both and it's there. I don't know. There's a certain magic that I'm really happy both have done well. I'm very eager, but I know that's a personal thing for me. I can't explain why it was globally as attractive. I wish I knew. For once, I'm kind of stumped.
I am a big believer of the success of Oppenheimer. It's down to what the article said in second. I'm a believer that the success of Oppenheimer is down to the titular director. It's Christopher Nolan. We are no longer living in the age of the blockbuster. You know, we're not living in the 80s and 90s anymore where if the new Schwarzenegger movie was out or Bruce Willis or X, Y, and Z movie, you know, with big movie star would come out that people would rush to the cinemas. We're not in that age anymore. There are very few directors left who also command that, you must go and see me. Scorsese, I would argue, still has that. Spielberg is hit and miss. I think if Spielberg, you know, the right word gets out, then people will still flock to a Spielberg movie, but he doesn't have the allure that he had in the 20th century. Nolan is a shining light in the modern age. Denis Villeneuve, I would argue, maybe has it too. But Nolan is a shining light amongst modern filmmakers. And a Christopher Nolan movie, there's no other way of saying it. It is event cinema. You know you're going to be in for something special with Nolan. It's a virtual guarantee. Whether even with Tenet, whether you liked it or not, there was something there. I personally didn't like Tenet, but it was an original, interesting movie, all but, I would argue, poorly executed. And it sounds like Oppenheimer, he's captured lightning in a bottle again. Like, you know, if this is as good as Inception or Interstellar or The Prestige, like, hell yeah, bring it on. I think Nolan's the draw. Anything to add on this?
Look, yeah, it's a weird one that I agree, but I disagree. Like, I get you, and I totally agree that he was an attraction. But again, look at the numbers that have come out in between. It's weird. He's an attraction, but there was something else there that I can't put my finger on. And that's the funny thing. You know, you talk about how Spielberg has it. If we could say Spielberg was there, I don't think Fableman done numbers. I could be wrong. No. But I don't think he did. And this is the thing. It's nice to see a director has that. And I will agree with you and the article that Nolan, I mean, look, go back a couple of weeks ago, our pod said it. Director of the 21st century is Christopher Nolan. So with that, I'm not going to disrespect the guy. I'm fully on par with that. But there's something more about this because the others have been, for better or worse, a Christopher Nolan creation short of the Batman movies. You know, what is Inception? What is a Tenet? What is an Insomnia? What, you know, they go on and they have their way. This is the first time short of Dunkirk that he's really delved into like historical facts or a biopic per se. And it's done something. There's something quite mystical about Oppenheimer that I'm loving that it's done well.
Nothing for me to add on this one, actually, guys. So I want to know, are you one of the people who saw Barbenheimer, who saw them both? Which of the two movies did you prefer? If you haven't seen Barbenheimer, have you at least seen Oppenheimer? And let us know what you thought. Do you agree that Nolan is the best director of the 21st century? As always, please leave your thoughts and your comments down below and do like the video and subscribe to the channel if you haven't done so already. Up next, we have got one last bit of hot off the press news before we crack on to some of the more trending stories that occurred last week. And it's a trailer that dropped literally today, a few hours before we hit the record button. And for me, it's I liked it. It's a very interesting one. The Exorcist trailer has now arrived. The brand new Exorcist trailer called The Exorcist Believer. So I'm not going to play the trailer because I don't want to have to go through the whole, hey, we got a copyright strike. Am I going to dispute it? Nope, go away, Nintendo Switch. It's online now. You can go and watch it. But exactly 50 years ago this fall, the most terrifying horror film in history landed on screens, shocking audiences around the world. Now, on Friday, October 13th, a new chapter begins. From Blumhouse and director David Gordon Green, who shattered the status quo with their resurrection of the Halloween franchise, comes The Exorcist Believer. Since the death of his pregnant wife in a Haitian earthquake 12 years ago, Victor Fielding has raised their daughter, Angela, on his own. But when Angela and her friend Catherine disappear in the woods only to return 3 days later with no memory of what happened to them, it unleashes a chain of events that will force Victor to confront the nadir of evil and in his terror and desperation seek out the only person alive who has witnessed anything like it before, Chris McNeil. For the first time since the 1973 film, Ellen Burstyn reprises her iconic role as Chris McNeil, an actress who has been forever altered by what happened to their daughter Reagan 5 decades before. Woo! AJ, let's talk. So, you've seen the original Exorcist at this point. You have?
I have seen. I'll be honest, half. I haven't seen the whole film. I've seen half.
Okay. That's shameful. That should have been on my top 10 cinephile list on principle. By the way, the top 10 movies every cinephile must watch is available right now on the channel, so please do go and check that out when you're finished with this. The Exorcist obviously has an aura about it. How do you think, based on the trailer alone, but, you know, we got a good 3 minutes here, of trailer here, so this was a good chunk of movie. How do you think this trailer looks? How do you think it compares to the feel of the original? Did it creep you out? Share your thoughts. Tell me.
So here's a few things. Everybody knows I'm not the horror fan. That's normally something that's out of me. And you sent the link and like, oh, new trailer, check it out, please, before the show drops. And I was like, okay. And I'm seeing The Exorcist, Believer. And I was like, okay, here we go. And I remember you sending a link for Exorcism of Emily Rose, and that was something that you saw and was interested in. And I was very much of a, I don't know if you have the right to call it The Exorcist without it being The Exorcist. Like, what kind of follow-on? It's going to be some cheap follow-up. How do you do it? And then I clicked the link, and I'm watching this trailer. And I'm like, okay, here we go. Basic horror tropes. They've gone. They've come back. She's been in a coma for 3 days. She thought it was a couple of hours. And then Catherine McNeil turned up, and that's when it got interesting. When I saw the original cast member in this and that expression of, I know what it is. And once that happened, I felt chills. Not from the character, because I'm not that familiar with the film. I've not finished it. But what came after, the horror and chill of how possessed these characters are, really got to me. It actually felt really interesting. So much so that I felt like, one, I didn't know that there was an Exorcist 2, and this is going to be Exorcist 3, I believe. I believe Linda.
Oh, no. No. There's way more than that. There's four Exorcist movies, even five, maybe.
Right. So I'm not too sure how deep it is, but fearing that this is the first time that the mum is back means something. I'm guessing it goes kind of deep. I was just kind of intrigued. I kind of felt like I need to go deeper into this lore. I was like, I definitely need to see one, if not anything else. At the time, I thought it was just two. But I was like, this has piqued an interest. Will I see it in the cinema? Depends on the company, if I'm honest with you. Depends on my mood. But I am highly intrigued. That's just my personal take on horror as to why I won't. But the chills were there. And that I'm very happy with, because I've always said horror doesn't scare me enough. I'm not saying I was scared, but you piqued an interest. So with that, I'm down.
Yeah, so I'm very, very much of the same opinion as you here. What gives me great hope isn't... It's not just seeing, you know, the return of Chris McNeil as Ellen Bernstein. That's super exciting, you know, for nostalgia's sake. But looking beyond nostalgia, the thing that has me excited is the name of the production, Blumhouse. Blumhouse have quietly gone about in the 21st century making uber profitable, small, tiny little budget horror movies with IPs that people are familiar with, reimagining them, putting a fresh coat of paint on them, and somehow making them not suck. They don't have a perfect record by any stretch of the imagination, but this, as the article said, this is a company which reimagined Halloween, and for the first movie at least did very well. This is a company that gave us the Paranormal Activity series. This is the company that gave us Insidious, a company that gave us Get Out, and the company that gave us Firestarter. And let me bring up a few more of their movies here, because it's quite... They gave us Black Klansman, Creep 2, Creep, Easy 6. You can go and check it out yourself. Happy Death Day, Lawless, Martyrs, like Ouija. They've got like a crazy library of really brilliant, small budget, well-made horror movies. And the fact that they are helming this, and the fact that they paid through the roof, this is an interesting thing the article didn't mention. They paid through the roof to make sure this has three. We're going to get three more Exorcists. Now, that always worries me when you're planning a trilogy and the first one hasn't even come out yet. It's like, easy. But we are getting two more of these, and the next one is apparently releasing in 2025. This trailer creeped me out. I'm a sucker for Exorcist movies, and this trailer creeped me out. It doesn't have the feel of the original, but I don't think that's a bad thing. It's like, acknowledge the original and find your own identity. I'm excited, but it's horror. I'm the horror guy. Of course I'm excited about this. What else is here, right? But I want to hear what you guys thought. Have you seen this new Exorcist trailer? What did you think? Leave your thoughts and your comments down below, and please do like the video and subscribe if you haven't already. Unless there's anything you want to add, AJ, we can move on to some trending news stories.
Yeah, the only thing I will touch on very, very lightly is I don't think a planned trilogy is a bad thing, because what scares me with a lot of other trilogies, Matrix is looking at you, it's when you make money out of the first and you then try to create a story. Whereas if you've got the idea for free, if it doesn't work out, the other two get scrapped and yeah, it sucks. But if you have a vision that can build along, it's the same way with, you know, Avatar's going on for God knows how many. You're like, ooh, at first I was shaky, but I was like, you've got a pattern, you know where you're going, because you've got such a depth of story. I don't think it's a bad thing to have it planned, as opposed to make money, now let's try and make more. Because that's when you're just cash grabbing and weaker stories, I believe.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point. Lord of the Rings being arguably the gold standard of do all three at once. Great point. All right, well, with all that said and done, let's move on to some other trending news stories that haven't happened in the last sort of 24 hours in a section that we just call News Update. Yes, News Update. So let's look at some, we've been talking a lot about box office this week. We're going to be talking more about box office now. And we've gone from super positive, and unfortunately, it's time to be reminded about the reality that when you're not Barbenheimer, you don't have much of a hope in hell in the year 2023. So, sucks, doesn't it? But yeah, the unfortunately, AJ, it seems that the Blue Beetle box office projections are not looking good. So here's the full story. This is from MovieWeb. Blue Beetle box office projections indicate the worst ever DCU opening and a terrible box office gross. Blue Beetle may have avoided cancellation by Warner Brothers Discovery, but projections for its box office are far from great news for the studio. The 2023 struggle for DC movies to make their impact on the cinematic landscape may be about to hit its own Mariana Trench with the arrival of Blue Beetle. According to box office predictions, Black Adam and The Flash both delivered reasonable opening weekends, but ultimately failed on account of their massive budgets. I don't know what this article is talking about. The Flash did not have a reasonable opening weekend. But anyway, and the less said about Shazam Fury of the Gods' underwhelming performance, the better. However, they could all pale in comparison to the incredibly low, wait for this, AJ, 12 to 17 million opening weekend being projected for Blue Beetle. Eesh. James Gunn, bless him, has tried to do his best to instigate some interest in Blue Beetle by making sure that everyone is aware that the character of Jamie Reyes will be carrying on in the new DCEU. Confuse me, but it seems that even that cannot get people into cinemas to watch DC movie. If the projection shared by Box Office Pro turns out to be accurate, not only will Blue Beetle have the worst opening of a DC movie in recent memory, discounting Wonder Woman 1984, which pulled in 16.7 million during its day and date release in the COVID pandemic, but the film is also predicted to earn just 55 million at the domestic box office in total. Considering the movie comes with a $120 million budget, this kind of result would be nothing short of another disaster for Warner Brothers Discovery. So, the article then goes on to talk about Blue Beetle's box office fail could make Batgirl's cancellation worse. I know this is going to rub you up the wrong way, AJ. As if things don't look bad enough for Blue Beetle's box office, the film star will not be coming out to promote the movie thanks to the ongoing actor strike, which is something that can only hinder any chance Warner Brothers Discovery had to try and drum up more interest in the film. Of course, there was at one point a chance that the movie may not even make it to cinemas, having originally been planned as a HBO Max exclusive along with Batgirl. Having been saved from the cull of projects that saw Batgirl scrapped, Blue Beetle now looks like it will be a bigger loss for the studio than Batgirl's release would ever have been. While there are many unknown superheroes that have hit cinemas, and become big hits for the DC franchise, to try to do that when even its biggest hitters are not doing the business almost set them up for a fail. While Blue Beetle is well known in some circles, yeah, the same sort of circles that said they knew who the Guardians of the Galaxy were before that movie came out, liars, for general cinema audiences, that is not necessarily true, and that certainly won't help the cause. In contrast, there were so many things going for Batgirl. I don't agree with that, but anyway, including appearances by Michael Keaton as Batman and Brendan Fraser as the villain Firefly. The film eventually became a tax write-off, disappointing many fans and creating a real sense of animosity towards Warner Brothers Discovery by fans who still cannot understand why a movie that was practically complete ended up being binned. Soon enough, we will know exactly how much of a bad financial decision releasing Blue Beetle was when the movie is releasing on August 18th at the penultimate DC movie of 2023. I mean, with respect, I'll go first on this one because there's a lot I just do not agree with in this article once I sort my Superman hair out. Even if Blue Beetle opens to as low as they're projecting, and even if Blue Beetle only makes 55 million at the box office, that's still 55 million then more than it would have made if it had gone straight to streaming. That's just a fact. You don't make money on streaming. We've already established this on the channel many a time when we've had people disagree and who have ended up with egg on their face all over. And it's been a joy to behold. Cinema is where the money is. I seem to be saying this every single week. 55 million is still more than zero. The article is trying to make out that the movie, which has a 120 million opening, the 120 million budget, which, by the way, in contrast to a lot of the big blockbuster movies this year, is actually quite a reasonable budget. I know it's crazy to say that 120 million is reasonable, but in contrast, it is. 55 million is more than it would have made on streaming. So I think this is portraying a bit of a one side of the argument, in my opinion. And I think it's very simple why the reason the Batgirl movie was panned. Because they watched it and saw that it was terrible and said, this is not worth even releasing on streaming. Bin it. This is going to damage our reputation. There's no other reason why they would have done it than that. AJ, your thoughts on Blue Beetle's potentially disastrous opening weekend?
Well, I love how the article... I'm just going to play games here. Because I love how the article says the worst ever DCU opening. This is the first film of the DCU, so what are we comparing it to? But taking that aside from the situation...
Sorry to cut you off, AJ. Remember, it's not the first DCU movie. It's the first DCU character.
Yeah, there we go.
Remember? See, I told you that would get confusing. Superman Legacy is the first DCU movie, but Blue Beetle is the first DCU character.
Yeah. This is the confusion of it all. I can't say I'm shocked. Blue Beetle to me is a character that I first came across when playing Injustice 2. I've seen him in a cartoon Justice League movie or two. I'm not sure, but I was very unfamiliar with this character. It was a bold move by DC to do this. I get that Marvel played a gamble and won with Blade, but that was Wesley Snipes at the helm. I can't tell you who's playing Jamie here, like, respectfully. And at the time, people didn't even know it was a Marvel movie. It was just a cool Vampire Hunter movie. This is definitely a superhero movie in the realm of superhero movies, in the world where superhero fatigue is also a thing. You're not giving me your strongest hitter. And it's... There are many factors I feel that are just not in Blue Beetle's favor. I go back to it. I would have started with Corin Sweat, you know, start with Superman, start with your biggest hitters, make Batman more interesting. Let's go with the names that we've got. If we're going to press the reboot, let's build those and then start to say that these are the characters that will be joining them later. The same way that, as you quoted previously, the Guardians of the Galaxy are coming, you know, the same way. And respectfully, I say this, Doctor Strange is coming. You know, people know Iron Man. People knew Thor. People knew Captain America.
Iron Man, Thor, You and me did.
I still feel you could get away with Iron Man more than you could Blue Beetle. Do you get where I'm going with this?
Right? 100%. But he's still a backup dancer, or was still a backup dancer.
And even in a weird world, I feel people were familiar with Shazam because he was Captain Marvel in a DC world, and that used to confuse the world. Blue Beetle, to me, is a newer character. So even the older comic book geeks can't get familiar with the guy. As I said, it took a video game to introduce me to this character. So all of these elements aren't proving positive for people to be like, oh, let me sign up. Like, it's just missing interest. And I don't know how you can drum that up. There's not even a promise of a feature of somebody, you know? I don't know what to say.
I mean, yeah, I don't have much to add to that. I mean, look, they could do something relatively cool. They could do something like, you know, have David Corin sweat in the post-credit scene and we get our first look of Superman. They could do something like that. You know, it doesn't take long to get an actor into a suit and to digitize a cape onto him. It's 2-3 days of work, essentially. But you've got a little thing called the actor strike going on. So even that seems like an impossibility at this point. So I don't know. I don't think this movie's salvageable. But I'll say this. I was actually really entertained by the traders. I'll definitely see this movie in the cinema. It looks like a barrel of fun. So that makes me sad. But, you know, it is the current trend at the moment. People are speaking with their money.
Look, it peaked in interest, and if it continues to peak in interest, people will head to the cinema. And if it's good, as the trailer makes out, people head to the cinema again, and it could be the underdog that no one expected. Will it beat Barbie for the year? Hell no. But it may still be an underdog that we were like, ooh, didn't see that coming.
Listen, I think at this point, if it breaks even, it'll be called considered a success by considering what the projections are. But yeah, we'll see what happens. Let us know down in the comments, guys. Are you going to be going to see Blue Beetle, or are you going to keep your money tight in your wallet or in your bank account? Let us know what you think and leave your thoughts in your comments down below. And we move on to our next story in the realm of Star Wars. AJ, it's time to talk about Star Wars. Let's bring out the sweaty nerds. Time for the toxic sweaty nerds of the Star Wars universe. Because we now have... I'm happy to hear this, I have to say. Our man, John Boyega, says he's open to appearing in a future Star Wars movie. So, John says some things in this article which I don't entirely agree with, but we'll move on. We'll adjust those. John Boyega has revealed that he's open to making a return to the Star Wars universe, but only if the project is the right fit for him. In an exclusive TechRadar interview to promote his new Netflix film, They Cloned Tyrone, Boyega confirmed that he hasn't fully closed the door on appearing in a future Star Wars film. Lots of money. However, he suggested it would have to be the right time for Finn, the character he played in the franchise sequel trilogy, to show up. Boyega's Star Wars future has been a hot topic of discussion since he criticized the decision to sideline ethnic minority characters as the sequel trilogy progressed. In Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens, Boyega's Finn played a big role in how its story played out. However, in Star Wars Episode 8 and Episode 9, Phil and Kelly Marie Tran's Rose Tico, to name just two characters, were moved to the periphery in favor of the franchise's white characters, such as Daisy Ridley's Rey and Adam Driver's Kylo Ren. In a lengthy GQ interview in September 2020, Boyega also hit out at certain sections of Star Wars fanbase for racially abusing him and Tran. At the time, Boyega said, "I'm the only cast member who had their own unique experience of that franchise based on their race. Let's just leave it like that. It makes you angry with a process like that. It makes you much more militant. It changes you because you realize I got given this opportunity, but I'm in an industry that wasn't even ready for me." Nobody else in the cast had people saying they were going to boycott the movie because they were in it. Nobody else had the uproar and death threat sent to their Instagram DMs and social media saying black this and black that and you shouldn't be a stormtrooper. Nobody else had the experience, but yet people are surprised that I'm this way. That's my frustration. In the near 3-year period since the interview, Boyega has made peace with his experience as a black actor in Star Wars. It's unclear that what the future holds for Finn in Lucasfilm's iconic universe, but there is growing speculation that we could see him again in a future Star Wars movie. And it goes on and he elaborates a bit on a few other things. Again, if I could go first on this one, because I think it's kind of two-pronged this. So I remember very clearly when the Force Awakens trailer dropped and people got very angry at John Boyega being a stormtrooper, and there were calls for no black stormtroopers. Like, it was utterly ridiculous and it was disgusting. You know, that was the first sign of the toxicity within the Star Wars fandom and in the wider movie sphere, which is, it's so sad. You know, we've spoken about this recently in other formats of racism towards actors. We were talking about our disagreement with Snow White being cast as a, you know, by as a Colombian last week. But we also said that you shouldn't be attacking the girl just because she's collecting a paycheck. That's ridiculous. Like, leave John alone. Leave Rachel Zegler alone. So I do remember those events happening, and it's horrible. And I can't even imagine what he went through and how, you know, his experience within Star Wars was driven by race, as he said. However, I do think he's driving a bit of a nasty line here by saying that the ethnic minority characters were sidelined in the following movies, as in after episode 7, so episodes 8 and 9. It is true, you know, Finn, who's black, was sidelined. Oscar Isaac, who's Hispanic, was sidelined. Kelly Marie Tran was sidelined. But it wasn't their movie. This was Rey's movie. And can we also recognize that it's the first time that it's been a female who was the lead? So you can pull the string each way here. You can, and it doesn't matter what you think of Rey, whether she's a Mary Sue, whether you love her, not the point. The fact is that with episode 7, some people would say it was going woke, but Star Wars was embracing a whole new identity that featured black, Hispanic, and women as their leads. Now, I know people will say, oh, but Princess Leia was one of the leads. She was a lead. She wasn't the lead. Rey was the lead. So I don't entirely agree with the way Boyega's phrased this. But again, of course, by his own admission, he's become quite militant about this because of the unfair treatment he got. But I obviously can't speak for a black man's experience within a movie production when he's been having death threats sent to his Instagram, which is disgusting. AJ, your thoughts on Boyega returning to Star Wars?
So I'm going to, the first thing I'm going to point out is I remember Daisy Ridley deleting all social media because I think she was getting a lot of attacks. So as much as John's waving the flag for his attacks, and I get it on a racial slur, he probably was the only one. And I don't know what Oscar Isaac went through. And trust me, I'm in support of John for that slight militancy. And I put it this way. Here's the thing. Episode 7 gave us characters that you could follow and like. You know, I remember saying, like, yeah, Finn's, this is pretty cool what Finn's doing. Obviously, I unpopular opinion, big Rey fan, huge Rey fan. You know, I will still rave that flag. If episode 7 is the rehash of episode 4, as the world likes to call it, and I'm not saying that you have to get Empire and what have you, but in the same vein that as much as you've got Luke Skywalker, you are able to get a Princess Leia, a Han Solo, and the rest, it wouldn't have hurt if we had got that with these extra characters. I think it's, dare I say, coincidental that they happen to be minorities. Yes. I don't think that had the roles been white reversed. Yeah, what I'm trying to say is that obviously Kylo Ren, there's no way John Boyega could be Anakin's grandson, so that would have been an issue. That would have been too stupid. But had you role reversed, I believe the characters would still be in the same situation. That is essentially what I'm trying to say. You know, it's just who you're playing and the way it worked out. Had Kelly Marie Tran and Daisy Ridley swap place again, how would she be Palpatine's granddaughter? But it works. You know, I think it's Rey is the situation. It's Rey and it's I can't remember his name. Why am I blanking? Kylo Ren. It's the characters behind the story. It's, guess what? The evil and good have reversed and now they're going to swap because there's a redemption story, which, again, go back to a very early episode. I called it, and I'm not a Star Wars fan, but you could just see the game they were playing. But it wouldn't have hurt to have had an extra focus on these characters. So will Finn come back? Yeah, but now how do you make it a story? Like, what are you going to do? Is it going to be in the same vein as Solo and we're just going to expand on that universe to show what this is what Finn was worth? Because what is Finn going to come back? What is John Boyega going to come back for without it being a fear of being a sideman again? Respectfully, because he said that's what he felt. What story are you going to do short of giving Finn the limelight to elevate that again? Because it could happen again in the next trilogy, that it starts off good, ends off weak.
Yeah, no, you make a very good point. I think the only way for Finn to come back, in the list of movies that they've got set up is for him to come back in the movie where which is the follow-up to Ray's story, because obviously Finn and Ray had a close bond. That would, you know, Finn and Ray's adventures in the galaxy far, far away, so that he's an equal side character to Ray like he was in episode 7. You can definitely capture that magic again in Ray's standalone movie that's coming up in the next few years. But play nicely now, Star Wars fans. Leave your thoughts and your comments in the section down below. What did you think of John Boyega as a Black Stormtrooper? And what do you think of the chances of John Boyega rejoining Star Wars? All right, our last news story today before we move on to Throwback Thursday. Kind of on brand because we are sticking with Christopher Nolan today. And this is something that has got me oh so excited. Read between the lines on this one, AJ, and think about where this franchise currently is in relation to what Nolan is about to say. Because this, for me, is life-alteringly exciting news. It's something that people have been discussing as a has to happen for a while, but it seems like it could be happening. Because AJ, Christopher Nolan would love to direct next James Bond movie, but only under the right circumstances. Now, that title alone has got me scrolling because I'm so excited for this, I can't tell you. Christopher Nolan is definitely open to helming a James Bond movie in the future. The Oppenheimer filmmaker has been tied to the franchise as a potential director one day, and he's now admitted taking charge of a 007 blockbuster would be, quote, an amazing privilege. However, he noted there would be a particular set of constraints imposed on him if he did step into the world of Ian Fleming's Spy. Nolan says, the influence of those movies in my filmography is embarrassingly apparent, so there's no attempt to shy away from that, he said on the Happy Sad Confused podcast. I love films. It would be an amazing privilege to do one. At the same time, when you take on a character like that, you're working within a particular set of constraints. Nolan would want to go into such a massive project at the right moment where at the right moment where he can leave his own mark while staying true to the character and the world, with fans wanting to find out who will take over the role from, I won't say his name, the last Bond. I refuse to say his name. He added, and so you have to have the right attitude towards that. It has to be the right moment in your creative life where you can express what you want to express and really burrow into something within the appropriate constraints, because you would never want to take on something like that and do it wrong. It's the kind of responsibility I felt very much taking on Batman. Nolan rose to the challenge with his Dark Knight trilogy, and he'd want to make sure that he had the perfect storm if he was going to take on Bond. He explained, you wouldn't want to take on a film not fully committed to what you could bring to the table creatively. So as a writer, casting, everything, that's the full package. You'd have to be really needed. You'd have to be really wanted in terms of bringing the totality of what you bring to a character. Otherwise, I'm very happy to be first in line at the cinema to see whatever they do. He's talked about the idea of directing a Bond movie in the past, and he's actually chatted to the producers over the years. I've spoken to the producers Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson over the years. I deeply love the character, and I'm always excited to see what they do with it, he told Playboy back in 2017. Maybe one day that would work out. You'd have to be needed, if you know what I mean. It has to need this is the line that's got me excited. It has to need reinvention. It has to need you. And they're getting along very well. Come on now. AJ, your thoughts on, first off, Nolan directing a Bond and on his words in this article?
I'm weirdly apprehensive. Now, this sounds weird because we've just come from celebrating the man as the director of the 21st century. But there is a Nolan style. And yes, I can understand his love of technology and time. But I don't know how that lends well to a Bond movie. Now,
forget time.
I'm not even looking at time. I'm just looking at a Nolan scope of direction. Now, there's a certain, again, I'm not the biggest Bond freak out there. I've done my Brosnans and I've done the Craigs. Short of that, I've dabbled in your Connerys and your Moores. Do you know what I mean? I can't tell you one from the other. Like, this is why I'm not the perfect guy for the top 10 Bonds. But hear what I'm trying to say. There's a style and a deepness in Nolan, which I appreciate, and he could character build. And I'm scared he might go too deep in the character and not enough in the action. Like, I'm kind of scared in the build of how it would work. I don't doubt the man can direct. Yeah. Look at Batman. Look at Batman, the Dark Knight trilogy. It took away from we always say it's not a superhero movie. It's a detective movie with a man who happens to be a superhero, right? Now lend that to the Bond world as well. That style gives you something where it's a detective, but I know he works well with gadgets. This is Nolan as opposed to Bond. But I'm just trying to see, and this is going to sound so wrong, the charisma and the action. I don't know if he can deliver it enough. It scares me. Like, I know he can deliver in films, but there's something about the charisma of Bond I can't picture being delivered from Nolan. I don't know why, but it just somewhat... It's just a few links in the chain that seem to be missing in what should be a perfect link, a perfect combination. It just slightly scares me.
Boy, I have never, in all our years doing this, disagreed with you more. I cannot imagine anyone on the planet better suited to directing Batman in its current needing I cannot imagine anyone on the planet better suited to directing Bond at this particular moment. Nolan said in this article, he will be there when the character needs reinventing. Check. He will be there only if he's allowed writing duties and casting duties. Well, that's kind of necessary, given that we're recasting Bond at the moment. Check. He will be there when he feels like he's needed. Well, he's just been responsible for the fourth biggest weekend opening in box office history, along with Barbenheimer. Check. He has, by his own admission, said that the way that the Bond movies have been filmed since the 60s has hugely influenced his style to the degree that it's almost embarrassing, which means that his style is superimposable and transferable onto a Bond. Now, you want to talk about epic action sequences. Think of things like The Black Hole and Interstellar. Think of things like the bridge scene and the hotel scene in Inception. Think of things like, think of moments of tension, like transfer Batman and Joker to something like Bond and Blofeld. I mean, you don't need Bonds to always be big, bombastic on the action. It needs a bit of that, but it needs to have that in dabbles. You know, some of the great Bond movies, like From Russia with Love, were not heavy on the action. Casino Royale had action scenes, but it wasn't that action heavy, you know? I think this is a match made in heaven, and I can't think of a better time for Nolan to take over the helm of Bond. But yeah, I want to know what you guys all have to say about this. As always, please leave your thoughts and your comments in the comment section down below, and please do like the video. And before you leave us, hit the subscribe button. And before you leave us again, stick around, because it's time to take that long winding road all the way down to the dusty avenues of TBT, the TBT Boulevard, AJ, for Throwback Thursday movies.
Guys, okay, it's Thursday. Well, for this segment, it is definitely. Get your hashtags up. We are throwing it right back 10 years, 20 years, and 30 years in the world of gems of movies that were released this week, 10 and 20 and 30 years ago. Okay, bro, hit me.
Yep, it's our classic movie watch, and we basically are now going to add a little something something to this for those of you who have watched regularly. We are going to decide whether these movies should be forgotten to the annals of history, of movie history, or if they're deserving of a rewatch, be that on streaming or a nice little Blu-ray 4K order. And AJ, 10 years ago this week, part two of this trilogy.
I hate when I hear that.
Right? From James Mangold, The Wolverine.
Was Man of Steel, did Man of Steel come up recently in our throwback?
Uh-huh, a few weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah. Because those were the two films that I had on Blu-ray when I first bought my PS4. So that tells me my PS4 is at a certain age right now. Yes, I'm a PS5 owner now. So that's the throwbacks I'm getting to it. It's a weird film, The Wolverine. Like, I appreciated it. It had good storytelling. But I also was, can we step away from Wolverine, please? Like, X-Men Origins just became more and more focused on him. Like, we had Wolverine, then The Wolverine, and you're like, really? And still nothing for Cyclops? Where's the Gambit movie? Like, it just started to get a bit tedious, you know? But saying that, it was still a very good movie. It was always secondary to me because of, I think, a bit of the Wolverine fatigue, and also for the fact that in that weekend that I got this machine, it was Man of Steel and Wolverine. Now, being a massive Wolverine fan and not being the biggest Superman fan, I was spun on my axis. Superman, Man of Steel blew me away so much that I never really remember The Wolverine. I kind of like, I've seen it, I've enjoyed it, but I think it's a one-time watch. I may have seen it twice, but it was Man of Steel that was the winner, that you know, upon purchase kind of thing. So do I have the Blu-ray? Yeah, it's in one of my really useful boxes somewhere. It's a thumbs up for me because it's not a bad film. It's a middle ground. It's not like, hey, it's just there.
I'm unsurprisingly probably a bit more critical of this movie than you are. I think there's something there. There's definitely something there in this movie. I like the idea of sending Wolverine to Japan. I like the idea of Wolverine taking up the samurai sword and fighting the coolest Japanese actor ever, Hiroyuki Sanada. It's like, so Wolverine's going to fight Hiroyuki Sanada. On that ground alone, I'm in. Like, I'm in like a mofo. The problem with this story, while I think the fight scene on the bullet train was so cool, hyper inventive. The movie falls off the face of the earth in Act Three when they bring in Silver Samurai, and it's just weak. I enjoyed the initial playing of history where Wolverine survives the nuclear bomb in Hiroshima and helps him, save someone in the process. And this someone then comes back for him later on in life. There was something there. It was nothing earth shattering or groundbreaking, but there was a modicum of something interesting there, but it didn't quite land. It had some fun set pieces, had some good ideas. I wouldn't ever suggest that you go out and add this to your collection, but if it's on TV, if it's on streaming, and you've never seen it, check it out. You could do worse, but it's a middle of the ground veering towards a down, just not quite a down for me. But watch it on streaming if it's there, but I wouldn't give this your money. 20 years old, AJ. Part two again. There you go. This is crazy. This is really crazy. Tomb Raider, The Cradle of Life.
Ah, good old Angelina. I do see Angelina, and I still do think to myself, she is Lara. I can't separate it. It's something.
Oh, God, I don't.
I still need to see Vikander's movie, so it's a bit unfair, but I feel like I need to play the game first. It's a different situation. I don't know if this is going to surprise you. It's a thumbs down. It's not one of those that I remember being fondly enjoying. I remember really enjoying Tomb Raider 1 as a movie. This one just felt a bit weak. I know this is what gives sequels a bad rap. Like, you get some films that you're all over, and then your others that is utterly forgettable. Is this the one where she repeats something like 3 or 4 times at the end, or was that the first? It just didn't stick to me. There was nothing redeemably memorable about this film. And that's the sad thing. If you are going to watch, if you're a completionist and you've seen Tomb Raider 1, then yes, go for it. Anything short of that, if it's like I enjoyed 1 and I'm happy at just that, I don't think you need to rush to number 2. I don't recall having a good time with this film.
Yeah, I'm very much going to mimic what you have to say. I think for me, I wouldn't even be that generous with part 1. I think part 1 was meh, it's fine. It's like, as bad, you know, this is coming, part 1 came out not too long after that Super Mario Bros. Movie came out, where video game movies were the laughing stock, along with comic book movies back then, they were the laughing stock. So Lara Croft came out and was like, okay, you're not terrible. We're grading on a curve here, but you're not terrible. Minimum standards have been met. It wasn't anywhere near meriting a sequel, other than the fact that Tomb Raider used to be a huge IP.
Biggest at the time.
Huge. Like, she was the lady of PlayStation. I mean, I don't think Lara Croft is the face of PlayStation anymore. Like, absolutely not. You've got your Ratchet and Clanks. You've got your Kratoses. You've got your Nathan Drakes. Like, Lara Croft doesn't register anymore.
It just, like, the new Tomb Raider collections come out and people don't talk about it. Tomb Raider and Metal Gear,
even though it's really good, by the way, the new Tomb Raiders are really good.
I'm not saying they're not, but the world just doesn't talk about it. I think some of the games just went the wrong way and it just really damaged them before the reboot. It really, really damaged Tomb Raider.
The movies were not great. The games that followed the movies were not on par with the original Tomb Raider 1 and Tomb Raider 2. Like, they just got progressively worse and worse and worse till it.
The original trilogy was good. After that, it went terrible.
Yeah. Angel of Darkness and all that was just like, ugh. Yeah. Just so bad. And listen, this movie, at least in the first Tomb Raider, she kind of raided sort of one tomb. She doesn't even raid tombs in this one. It's just like generic action movie with white people. It's like, okay, so it's a hard thumbs down for me. I certainly wouldn't add this to anyone's digital or physical media collection. I wouldn't even waste your time watching this, to be honest. If it's on, move on to the next channel. I think this can be forgotten in the anime industry, especially considering the Vikander version is way better.
It's a step above a Uwe Boll movie.
Okay, it's again, grading on a curve. Getting hard on a curve. 30 years old, AJ.
Woo.
We have 2 movies in the 30-year-old category this week. One of them, a worldie, one of them that I think is going to send shivers down your spine. Which would you like first?
Let's go for the worldie.
One of, in my humble opinion, the all-time great comedies. It's a favorite here. Cary Elwes as Robin Hood, Men in Tights.
Jesus Christ. Men in Tights. This is when people knew how to do spoofs. This is when people knew how to do slapsticks. And, oh, I don't know where it fits in this world, but on a personal level, it's a thumbs up. It's a has to be seen. I don't know what the generations beneath me will say, but I had great fun with this. This is what this has done is thrown me back to a time when we were Sky owners. And this is my family. I can't speak for anyone else. So when I say we were Sky owners, you may still be a Sky member.
Still am, brother.
Sky Movies, Sky Movies just used to churn out the same movies over and over again. And this is one that we had so much fun with. Like, I can't say I didn't. It's amazing how you can watch something so many times but be a bit blank along the way. But I remember having great fun with it and watching it every time it came up. It was great fun. Nothing but fun memories. I don't know where it fits in the world, but if you can relate to the silver screen dudes and our style of comedy, this is definitely one for you. If you just appreciate the news delivery, it's more of a thumbs here, like middle ground. I will never give it a thumbs down. So it's going to be middle ground or thumbs up. That's just where it sits. It depends on your age and how you embrace comedy of a bygone era. I just have to be real with that.
You're quite right. It very much is comedy of a bygone era, as we don't really get slapstick anymore, sadly. You know, the scary movies, the not another teen movies, the vampire movies, all of the your Vampires Suck or Meet the Spartans, all of those modern slapsticks were so bad that they kind of killed the slapstick genre. I would argue that it could use a revival now.
In
But
the right hands,
this
in the right hands.
in the right hands, correct. You know, I wouldn't want to see them cast someone like Will Ferrell in a slapstick movie. It would just be painful. He's slapstick without being slapstick. But this came out in an era where Mel Brooks, you know, was at his, you know, we had Blazing Saddles, we had Dracula Dead and Loving It, we had this, you know, these are all, we had Spaceballs, these are all must-see
Hot shots,
slapsticks.
like,
Hot Shots, Hot Shots Part Deux,
yeah,
Naked Gun,
Naked Gun.
Spy Hard. Yeah, man. Austin Powers, I would argue, is a slapstick. You know, we had.
Yeah, that is the last of the spoof, really. That was the only good one, then it went into stupidness.
Then it went into stupidness. This is a real slice of cinematic history. I would say if you're a physical or a digital movie collector and not just a streamer, definitely add this to your collection because it's going to become progressively harder and harder to find. So you want to preserve that piece of cinema history. It has got, listen, it's a great time if you're drunk. It's a great time if you're stoned. It's a great time if you're sober. It really doesn't matter because it's just laughs all around between the references that they make to the other Robin Hood movies when Robin Hood was played by American actors. Because unlike other Robin Hoods, I have a British accent. Sorry, one of the all-time brilliant comedy slapstick lines. So good. Little attention to details, like the way that Prince John's mole keeps moving all over his face, the Sheriff of Nottingham with his speech impediment. You know, even Patrick Stewart gets in on the action playing King Charles at the end. It top to bottom, it is such fun. Maid Marian with her chastity belt. Call a locksmith.
Call the locksmith.
Call the locksmith. Darling, it won't open. You know, Dave Chappelle getting in on the action. You know, it was fun. Such fun. So it's a definite thumbs up for me. And I would say you must find this movie if you haven't seen it. Even if you don't like it, experience it for the first time.
I can agree with that. I could agree with that.
And we go from a high to a low, AJ.
Oh,
Do you
sugar, I
remember
thought you.
when, yeah, now, do you remember when Saturday morning cartoons were awesome? And then they
Yeah.
started to turn our Saturday morning cartoons into movies, and they lost sight of what they are. 30 years old, AJ. The Tom and Jerry movie.
Do you know a fun fact?
You've
I've only
never
seen
seen
10 minutes
this.
of the film. I've only seen 10 minutes of the film. I've
Did
seen
they
them
speak?
realize I so here's the sad thing about the Tom and Jerry movie. Was I excited to see it? Yes. And it's weird that I still haven't got around to seeing it. And I'm gonna say this very quietly. My ex had that film, and I think she used to watch it quite a bit. Just yeah, weirdly had it. And one of the things that I remember that I always remember threw me off and kind of put me off as much as I wanted to see it. It intrigued me, but always put me off. Tom and Jerry spoke. And that felt extremely wrong because for generations, like my dad grew up on Tom and Jerry. My dad introduced me to Tom and Jerry, and not a single word was said. We had the probably very racist and not to be seen in the modern day cartoon, old lady who owned the house ran Thomas, and that was as much as you heard, or you'd hear in a dog talk. But Tom and Jerry will never ever talk. Like it's just the way it was. And then mysteriously the film opens up and it's like, oh, you can talk, so why have you never spoken? I didn't think you could talk. And that was the kind of that's as much as I've seen in the film, and I just never got a chance to go deeper. What I will say, and this sounds extremely wrong, I can't put a thumbs up, I can't put a thumbs down or a middle ground. It does feel like this cartoon is better than the one that Chloe Grace Moritz was in. That's the only upside I can give this. I've not seen either, but it just felt like it was a better delivery than that one. I really wish I could say more.
Couldn't tell you about the Chloe Grace Moretz one because haven't seen that. But Tom and Jerry, look, the fact what you've just said is wonderful. Your dad introduced it to you. My great grandmother introduced it to me. It was pure Saturday morning cartoon goodness. It was like a flavor of the 70s, 80s, 90s, you know? It was, this is the cartoon you watch. And you didn't need to have the characters speaking because it was so well written and so simple in what they were doing that you didn't need dialogue. It was a story told through movement. It was good. And, you know, people will argue, well, how would you do a Tom and Jerry movie if they're not going to talk? Quite simple. If you can't figure that out, don't do the movie. Because in doing so, you have completely lost touch of who the characters are. In 20 minutes, there is... Go onto YouTube and look up a Tom and Jerry episode called Blue Cat Blues. In 20 minutes, without any proper dialogue, they managed to show you... They managed to tell a really cohesive narrative about Tom falling in love with a girl who's out of his reach. They managed to tell you... They managed to do a narrative commentary on social classes. They managed to reinvent the relationship between Tom and Jerry as friends instead of enemies, and they become kind of frenemies by the end. But Jerry's there to pick him up, and when he's feeling down and heartbroken and broke and suicidal, all without needing to speak. Powerful cartoon filmmaking. It's on YouTube, Blue Cat Blues. Go check it out. And in that 20 minutes, they managed to do more than anything in the hour and a half that the movie could do. And it was without talking. I would give a thumbs up to the Tom and Jerry IP. I would say go and watch some classic Tom and Jerry and, you know, turn a blind eye to the racist nanny, as you said, because it's a different time. But hard thumbs down to the Tom and Jerry movie, because it lost the essence of what the Tom and Jerry franchise is. And that does it for this week's edition of Silver Screen News. Thank you, as always, so much for joining us right here on our YouTube channel. Thank you for helping us reach 120 followers. It's really, yeah, really appreciated. 120 subscribers. But I still see a lot of you watching and not subscribing. So if that is you, hit the subscribe button down below. And you can join us every single Wednesday for the latest edition of Silver Screen News. And every single Tuesday for our new movie, Mount Rushmore Top 10. Keep it on the channel because we've got a new video coming out every day with all the latest trending news stories. So until next week, from myself, I'm Nico Luro.
I'm the one AJ Anthony Jordan.
And we will see you guys next week. Thank you so much for joining us. Now go to the cinema and watch some movies.